Thanks for inviting me back again after yesterday. So today I'm going to completely change gears. So today I'm going to talk about bosons and the fermions and completely different experiment. And what we're interested in is how.
I guess you can fit them from your.
Oh, my.
Speak up.
What we're interested in is how disorder affects transport of superfluidity and how it affects the coherence properties. So we've known for more than 50 years that transitions to insulating states can be driven by interactions or disorder. And there's some, you can make some kind of a quasi-phase diagram where you might have a superfluid or a superconductor in this corner where interactions and disorder are small. Up on this end, an Anderson local insulator. And over on this end, a mod insulator where the interactions are big and the disorder is small. And in the middle, you have various phases, such as Bose-Glass phases, that are some kind of intermediate between these two, where disorder is still important, but also interactions are not zero as they are in an Anderson insulator. And so this interplay between disorder and interactions is still very poorly understood. It's a subtle subject and relevant to many things in physics, including things like granular superconductors, superfluid helium and porous media, and even in high TC materials. And so cold atoms, we hope to provide a new insight into these mechanisms, into this kind of quasi-phase diagram here, because there is the opportunity to vary parameters, such as the disorder strength, disorder size, the interaction strength, and so on, in a continuous way. And so there have been a number of experiments in the last 5 years or so, probably most notably the Florence group and the Orsay group, now in Palaiseau, France, where they've recently seen Anderson localization of very weakly interacting gases. And also work that's being done in Hanover and in our group at Rice that I'll talk about today. So here's some of the examples where disorder is important. This goes back about a decade as Alan Goldman's plot of the sheet resistance of a thin film superconductor as a function of thickness, which you can interpret as a function of increasing disorder. And you find at some point, as you go down in temperature, at some point it's a insulator and it crosses over to a superconductor for a certain amount of disorder. And so there's a transition which is driven here by increasing disorder from a superconducting state to an insulating state. Similar things are, you can think of this in terms of granular superconductors where you have islands of superconductivity where STM measurements have shown that you can have little pockets of local superconductivity surrounded by something which is basically a global insulator. And so there's a lot of interesting questions that these materials have brought up, fundamental questions about how disorder affects superconductivity. How does it destroy the order parameter? And what is the relationship between phase coherence and superconductivity? And so these are some of the questions that we hope to address by the measurements that I'll describe today. So this is an experimental overview. This is basically all I will say about the experimental apparatus. There's one more slide. But there is some disorder which is produced by optical speckle. I'll describe that in a moment. And then there's the ability to tune parameters, as I mentioned before, and we saw this yesterday in the context of the BEC-BCS crossover, there is a Feshbach resonance in these atoms, that generally, and that enables you to tune S-wave scattering length, which gives you the ability to tune interactions over wide ranges. And I'll show that in a moment, where you can go from basically a non-interacting gas to an attractive one. This is an atomic soliton, or to repulsive gas. And the kind of measurements that we're doing are transport measurements. So we're looking at static pinning. We're slowly dragging the condensate through the disorder. But we're also looking at things which are more related to ohmic damping, to dissipation, where we move the condensate through the disorder or through a defect, and we look at how superfluidity is damped. We also have done some density measurements in situ, means in the trap, in the presence of disorder, to try to understand how the coherence is changing under these conditions of increasing disorder. And so this coherence can be probed by time of flight. Morning, Jason. So this is actual data. This shows the damping of these dipole oscillations in a harmonic trap in the presence of disorder. So you start the condensate on a wall of this harmonic potential. It oscillates back and forth, and because of the presence of the disorder, that motion slowly dissipates. All right. So here's how you generate optical speckle. You need a laser, you need a sandblasted piece of glass, you need a lens, and that's it. And which is really, it's really beautiful. So all of us know what optical speckle is. So if I shine this, if you came up really close, you'd look at that closely and you'd see all kinds of little bright and dark fringes. And that's because of the coherence property of the laser. And if you have a bunch of random emitters, then you get something which is completely random over here in the image plane. And if you do an autocorrelation of that disorder of that image, then you see something which is Gaussian, which has a characteristic length of the distance scale of the disorder. And so in this case, that distance scale is 15 microns. We've recently reduced it down to about 4. And it's tunable. You simply put an aperture up here, and by diffraction theory, the smaller the aperture, the bigger the length scale. So this is a plot. This is a cut through that image. And it just shows the random peaks and valleys, and you can characterize the height by some RMS deviation that we call VD. And that height is adjustable. So this is proportional to the intensity of the laser. And so you can adjust the intensity, VD, and you can adjust the length scale, sigma. Yeah?
You said you got it down to 4. Is smaller correlation length better?
Smaller is better, generally, because if you're interested in more single particle effects, where rather than just clumping of the condensate, then you want the healing length of the condensate, its coherence length, to be big compared to the disorder scale.
What is the characteristic coherence length?
The coherence length is governed by the interactions. And so I'll describe that in a moment. Okay. So this is what the condensate looks like. It's an elongated cigar-like shape. It has a ratio of frequencies of about 60. It's a lithium-7 condensate in some particular hyperfine sublevel. The chemical potential is tunable because of the tunable interactions. And this disorder is very tight in the radial direction. And depending on the chemical potential, it's either in a 3D or a 1D regime. If the chemical potential is less than this omega R, then you're in the 1D regime, otherwise in the 3D regime. Now this radial size is kind of comparable to it's actually a little less than the disorder length scale, and so the potential is effectively 1D. Okay, so the disorder is coming in through this way, and it really is only effective along this Z axis. All right, so these are the states, the hyperfine sublevels of the lithium ground state, the 2s 1/2 ground state. There are, because I is equal to 3/2, there are 8 magnetic sublevels. This is the 1-1 state, and the 1-1 state is interesting because it has this broad Feshbach resonance. And so we prepare all of the atoms into this lowest going magnetic sublevel. We go to something around 700 Gauss, where the scattering length has this collisional resonance, and so that you can tune the scattering length anywhere from some very large and positive values to very small and positive or negative values. Now, this zero crossing is actually very interesting. It's very shallow. It has a slope of only 0.1 atomic units, that's the Bohr radius, per Gauss, which means that with relatively minor field stability, relatively easily, that you can get a essentially non-interacting gas. All right, so this is a paper actually that came out Friday, and we got one of those little red, those little chili peppers on the paper. This is the first time in my career we got the little chili pepper. I'm not sure how they choose those, but anyway, we were all glad to see that. So the way we extract the scattering length is by the size of the condensate, and the bigger it is, the bigger the positive interactions. And as you decrease the interactions, the condensate gets smaller and smaller. These are the same scale, actually, until you can decrease the interactions sufficiently small that you can get in the quasi-1D regime. And that pretty much occurs down in here, below about one Bohr scattering length. And so up in here, it's all 3D. There's seven decades of dynamic range. We can go from about 0.01, that's about our sensitivity, up to about 10 to the 5 in atomic units. This is a blow up of this region. This shows the scattering length as a function of field right around that zero crossing. And as I mentioned before, it has this extremely shallow slope. This shallow slope is unique to lithium, and so it's really very attractive for doing these kinds of measurements because you have this this handle on the interactions. So these are solitons. If you go through the other side of the resonance, it will collapse into, this is a modulational instability, it collapses into a soliton train. This is something that we saw about 5 or 6 years ago. And now we can make these trains with something like 15 solitons in them, each of which is interacting with itself in some complicated way. And that's an interesting area of research in of itself, but I really won't talk about that. The other thing I'm not really going to talk about is this region up in here. These four data points all have Na cubed much larger than 1. And so they're already beyond the mean field theory. We can't extract the scattering length accurately from the size when we look at these four points. So we didn't include them on these fits, which are shown here as these red and green lines. But nonetheless, we show them on the plot. And it is possible to get to a very, very strongly interacting regime.
How stable are those guesses?
They're not very stable. And so when Na cubed is of order 1, it's stable. I mean, we can look at it from our perspective. We can look at it for hundreds of milliseconds, if not seconds. By the time this parameter gets up to about 30 or so, it's maybe a few tens of milliseconds. A little less.
But length of the order 1 is very different from the GP prediction already.
Yeah. And the profiles look different. So Fei Zhou actually wrote a paper on this in the last few months. And he's pointed out that the chemical potential is flattened out. And so the density profiles are actually much different than Thomas Fermi. And it seems like that is in agreement with our data, but we haven't really explored that very thoroughly. All right. So when you get to very small S-wave scattering lengths, the magnetic dipole-dipole interaction can become important. And for our values of the magnetic moment, which is 1 Bohr magneton, the mass of lithium and so on, it works out that for A less than about 0.6 Bohr, that the dipolar interaction should be very important. These are anisotropic interactions. It's a dipole, magnetic dipole-dipole interaction. And you can actually see that. So if you look at the extracted scattering length, if you neglect the dipolar term in the Gross-Podievsky equation, then you see that there's a variation in the scattering length that you get depending on the frequency of the trap. So the confinement of the trap. If you include the dipolar terms, then there's a very nice agreement And so there is a real effect here. It's not a very big effect, and it only occurs when the scattering length is very small. Still a tiny, tiny dipolar interaction. And it's nothing like the in Stuttgart, they have chromium, which it's got a bigger mass, and it's got 6 times bigger magnetic moment. So it's a much bigger dipole force. But nonetheless, you can be sensitive to it. Excuse me. All right. So this is the first type of measurement that we're doing, which is a kind of a static measurement. We take the condensate, produce the condensate in this harmonic potential, and then slowly drag it. We move the potential and slowly drag it through the disorder and watch what happens. So if VD is small, if the amplitude of this disorder is not very big, the condensate follows along. You're putting a force on it and you're just dragging it. But on the other hand, if VD is large and you try to drag it, the condensate will be pinned. And the question then is, how big is VD to distinguish these two different circumstances in comparison to the chemical potential of the condensate?
Sorry, what is this parabola?
I'm sorry. The parabola is a trap.
Yeah, but what is the second one?
It's the trap in a new center. So we apply a magnetic gradient, which moves the trap axially. So this is the original position of the trap. This is the final position of the trap. We move it by this distance d by applying a magnetic gradient.
Oh, so in the second case, the trap has moved to the left.
Yes.
But the condensate is still.
Correct. Okay. So the condensate is actually up here.
So this right-hand side parabola is the original trap position. Isn't it?
Yes, this is the original. This is the original parabola. This is the final trap. Yes. And distance d is how far we've moved it. All right, so this is the result. So if there's no offset at all, then this is where the trap begins. Without any disorder, the offset by distance d, the condensate moves to the left by that amount. Now, if you start applying a disorder of magnitude, which is kind of comparable to the chemical potential of the condensate, then the condensate begins to be pinned. In this case, it's really stretched out over the whole region, but with even greater disorder strength, then it's literally just pinned there. You can plot that as a function of disorder strength on this axis, and this is the amount that the initial displacement. This is small initial displacement. This is a medium displacement. These are large displacements from the equilibrium position. But in all cases, the condensate is essentially pinned. It doesn't move. This is the original position. It doesn't move when the disorder strength suborder the chemical potential.
And it depends on how fast you move it.
It does. And we're going to get to that. So this is all static. And so this is all adiabatic. So that if you moved any slower than this, it wouldn't make any difference.
So you're saying that for kind of even for small disorder, well, for small disorder, we expect that in the static limit, you equilibrate completely to the new position. So you would expect that there's no dependence at all up to a critical point. So the curve should be absolutely flat up to a critical point, and then it should go down.
But it's not critical. And so what we see is there's intermediate. So this is the original, this is with no disorder, and so it moves completely, as you say. This is when the disorder is really big and it doesn't move at all. But this is somewhere in between.
So is this 1D of a shield or is it?
No, it's 3D.
Mm-hmm. But Randy, also it seems the size changes also.
It does.
So do you have a data for this, how the size changes as you go across?
We don't plot that, but what we're plotting here actually is the center of mass of this distribution. And it's not critical. You know, it doesn't have that flat dependence and then suddenly slip. Why not? I mean, I don't know why you'd have.
The dots look like there is this critical point, and roughly at 1,
yeah,
plus minus 0.05. All the curves meet at the same point, more or less, within the spread of them.
That's true, and yes, but the slope is, you know, it's not flat and then suddenly drop off, but rather there's a slope like this, and it really spreads out. That for some intermediate disorder, it really spreads, the condensate spreads out over the trap, and some of it's pinned and some of it's not. And I think, you know, you can understand what's going on, because in this case the healing leg very small, and so you get little pockets of condensate which are collecting on these, you know, against these hills, and when the chemical potential is equal to the size of that hill, then the rest of the atoms slide over the top of it. And so it's not like it's, you know, there's some friction and suddenly it's breaking.
So another experiment question. So you actually turn on the speckle after the post condensation has taken place.
Yes. And we let it equilibrate.
Okay, and after a while then you.
Yes.
You know, I think the interesting point that, the question how that argument applies to the case where to when you're getting deeper and deeper into the high barrier limit, that argument would say that as I increase the barrier, I will chop it into pieces, but then it doesn't say how big the size of object is. But the data seem to show that as I enter the deep lattice regime, that the barrier regime and actually spread out and seem to contract again. And I was wondering.
Yeah,
I think the
width is interesting, and I think another maybe something to get at your point is if we were to repeat this experiment in the 1D regime, or repeat this experiment when the interactions are very small. If the interactions are small, and the healing length becomes large compared to these bumps and valleys, and then you might expect qualitatively very different behavior.
So Randy, when VD is equal to mu, how do you know for sure there is a condensate to begin with?
How do we know there's a condensate?
Yeah.
The usual techniques, we image it and we fit it to a Thomas Fermi distribution, and you look in the wings for the non-condensed part.
Uh-huh.
And so there's always some uncertainty in what the condensate fraction is. But it's going to be at least 50 or 60%. The T over TC is below 0.5, and the condensate fraction at least 90%.
But I mean, when you do your Thomas Fermi, do you take into account the random potential?
No.
Okay.
No. So all of this chemical potential, it's normalized the chemical potential without the disorder.
Okay.
That's the.
The overall shape still Thomas Fermi?
Yeah, without disorder, it's Thomas Fermi.
But with disorder, then it's...
With disorder, it and I'll show this later, but we'll show in situ images, and depending on the disorder strength, it begins to fragment. I'll show that in a second.
There's also no signature of any two-fluid picture, that there's a kind of a superconducting part and a superfluid part fraction which moves in a non-superfluid fraction. Don't see anything like that.
There's
no fragmentation two parts happening anywhere.
Yeah. No, we haven't interpreted it in that way. It's, you know, no evidence of that.
I have kind of a dumb question, and maybe it's more of a theorist question, but maybe you can answer it anyway, or someone else can. But I'm confused by what it means by adiabatic here.
Mm-hmm.
So if I really think just of the full quantum Hamiltonian,
mm-hmm,
and ask, you know, say, suppose I'm moving things slowly enough that I'm satisfying the adiabatic theorem,
mm-hmm,
then I should, you know, unless there's some, you know, some level crossing, which there probably isn't in the disordered mm-hmm. system, I would expect to end up in the ground state.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you're clearly not ending up in the ground state mm-hmm. since you're not near the minimum of the will for stronger disorder.
Yeah.
So it means you can't be satisfying atomicity in a real quantum sense.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether what it means is you're satisfying adiabaticity of the, think about just the time-dependent solutions for the Gross-Piotrowski equation.
Yeah.
Is that what one means?
Well, no, I guess I disagree that it's definitely not in the ground state, because if you were to go back to, say, this situation and you were just to put a barrier here, I just put a wall there, and so that the condensate couldn't slip by that wall.
Well, see, there's always tunneling in principle, right? So it means that you're moving it fast enough that you don't allow it to tunnel. But you know, truly adiabaticity, you would actually tunnel through the barrier. And
it may be a question of time. It may be a question of time scale.
Not adiabatic. So, you know, clearly, if the minimum of the will is over here and you're stuck over there, you're in a high energy state, right? There is a lower energy state. Probably some big barrier you have to get across.
Yeah, and the tunneling time might be years. In our experiment,
think about it.
Seconds. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the way we're thinking about it is just that the condensate gets trapped against these barriers, these walls, which are kind of comparable in height to the condensate energy itself. And so these walls, you know, the disorder length scale is big in comparison to the healing length.
Right.
So tunneling is not, it's probably not important here.
There is a classical element of it there.
I think so too.
I think Matthew was stating an experimental fact that if you drag it along with certain speed below which it doesn't make any difference.
Oh, sure. It's not the universe to get
there. Well, it's yeah, or at least faster than a couple of seconds. Age of the universe, couple of seconds.
Well, okay, the lifetime of gas.
Yeah,
maybe that's
yeah. That's
how long does it live actually?
I'm sorry. What?
How long can you keep the gas in this state?
A couple of seconds.
And then it leaks, or?
Then there's various things that limit the lifetime. There are various technical issues: vacuum pressure. Light scattering from the trap, various things like that.
So let me maybe amplify that. So, is it possible that these things can just be explained by just solving the Gross-Piotrowski?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's completely classical.
Okay.
Yeah, we're definitely, this experiment definitely in the classical regime. And And answering your question,
classical has different meanings. So this means still there's weak localization. The Gross-Piotrowski equation knows about localization.
Some sense it does.
No, it knows about everything. Weak localization, strong localization, that has all in it. So
at a single particle level, it knows about.
Yeah, sure.
That
sense.
Mm-hmm.
So
not in the same.
So the word classical has different meanings. So it has.
That's why I asked the question. That has a well-defined meaning. Classical, or if it's within the
Gross-Piotrowski. Exactly. Okay. All right. So, since this is all static, at least on relevant timescales, the velocity is much less than the Landau critical velocity, and we're not measuring this ohmic regime, rather measuring a static properties of the condensate. And so the question is what happens if you were to move the condensate at a rapid rate through the disorder and look at the dissipation or the damping that causes.
When you say this can be explained by GP, then you mean that it has been simulations that verify it.
Yeah.
But does the simulation also tell you about understanding about the size of this condensate as it
drags? I think that if you were to solve the Gross-Piotrowski equation, and we haven't done it for this particular system, that yes, you would explain the width as well. That's my sense. Okay, so the other experiment is basically the same as the last one, but instead of slowly displacing the trap. We suddenly displace the trap. That causes the condensate to oscillate back and forth. There's no disorder, it just oscillates forever, a few seconds. And in the presence of disorder, it damps. And so there's some dissipation. And so this is a movie of that, essentially a time sequence of images of the condensate. So it starts on the side of the potential and begins to oscillate, and those oscillations go on for a long time. This probably is, this period is about a third of a second. And so that's a few seconds. If you introduce a little bit of disorder, in this case about a tenth of the chemical potential, then you can see that oscillation becomes damped. There's some dissipation that the disorder imposes. So these are a sequence of, this is pretty cluttered and I apologize for that, but it's a sequence of trajectories of the center of mass of the condensate for various disorder strengths. So the black is no disorder, there's no damping. The red is very weak disorder, that's the images that I showed before. The blue is a little bit more, and the purple a little bit more. And you can see these are all underdamped, but as soon as you go above about a third of the chemical potential, it becomes overdamped, and eventually this kind of settles in, and when the chemical potential becomes is comparable to the disorder strength. So this is also, the Florence group has done some similar work to this. And this, again, with 200 Bohr, is in the 3D regime.
Can we go to the previous picture?
Previous picture.
Yeah. So you see the intensity also seems to be, so are you losing atoms as you are, as this is happening? Because by the time you reach here,
no, they're just spread out. And so their density, they're spread out throughout the trap and their density is diminished. And so that's why it doesn't look as, the signal is not as strong. So it's the same thing that Jason was talking about, is that not only does the center of mass position change, but also the width of the cloud. All right, so what we see is there's dissipation even for relatively small disorder strength, and it's overdamped for larger disorder strength. And so what you can say is that the global superfluidity is lost. Certainly it's not moving anymore as a superfluid, and so beyond that disorder strength, you have gone into essentially an insulating state. So how does this damping depend on velocity? You can change the velocity in the system by changing the amplitude of motion. And so if you displace the trap by a larger amount, then the velocity, the maximum velocity at the bottom of its oscillation in the harmonic well, will be higher. And what we noticed is in this particular sequence this is a time on the horizontal axis and position on the vertical axis. And what you see is that the oscillations are damped at a relatively slow rate initially, and then at a relatively high rate in the middle, and then in here, relatively slow again. And so evidently, what's changing is the velocity throughout the oscillation. So evidently, the damping rate is velocity dependent, and it's maximum in here, relatively small for high velocities and relatively small for low velocities. So this just says that the velocity is changing with the amplitude and the oscillation. You compare that velocity with the Landau critical velocity, which is the chemical potential over the mass, square root of that. And if you then start condensates with different amplitudes, and the velocity is the amplitude times the frequency, then you can plot out the damping coefficient, which is extracted from fitting these kinds of trajectories, as a function of velocity. And you see that the damping is maximum right here at the Landau critical velocity. So this means that superfluidity is breaking down for higher velocities, it's behaving more as a classical gas, but down in here, it's behaving as a superfluid. And there's a relatively sharp turn on of the damping.
So this is for 3D and weakest order?
Is that- yeah, this is 3D. This is relatively, I don't have the disorder on here, it's relatively weak disorder, but it's also relatively weak interaction strength. So it's 25 bor, still in the 3D limit, but not far into it. Yeah.
So why is there not
zero below critical velocity?
Why is it not zero?
Yeah, why is not zero below some critical velocity being smaller than the standard critical velocity?
Because the velocity is actually changing. You know, throughout this, you know, it's not a constant velocity. Yes. And so what we're really plotting is a maximum velocity. And
I have the naive expectation that there's a superfluid, and the superfluid, there's a small fraction with very small amplitude. So there should be some part which oscillates forever, essentially, because it's superfluid. That's what superfluidity is about.
There's two things that...
There must be something wrong with
there's that. Two things that mitigate that experimentally. One is that there's a velocity range, and the other thing is the cloud doesn't have a uniform chemical potential. It doesn't have a uniform density. And so the velocity, the critical velocity, is going to be different for different parts.
Well, I think to make him happy, maybe if I can do momentum distribution, and then I mean, I think he's concerned whether there is in fact a condensation.
Whether
how the condensation fraction actually reflects in these experiments. I mean, despite that, this is classical, but there's still an issue whether how the condensate get destroyed. And I think they also, I mean, looking at these figures, then I think there might be some connections to some of the Rapi experiments. They also have measured critical velocity. In their cells, and I think there's some similarity in these features. But eventually, they're going to ram up the lattice height, and then you go into a regime where you begin to break down superfluid. Mm-hmm. And since you are in 3D situations, so that even in a good superfluid, the flow pattern is very non-uniform because the super very lumpy. Mm-hmm. And that pattern itself is also very interesting because it would give rise to a superfluid density, which is very different from superfluid fraction. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just saying that there could be some useful insight that have the understanding of another area studies. And so, do you have results for higher lattice height?
Higher disorder?
Yes.
We'll get to that. So this actually, this curve just comes from this analyzing this in different sequences. So this is just for this one condition. So one oscillation.
Suppose you start the amplitude with it's sort of having high damping.
Yeah.
You don't start it the way you at a larger. Suppose you had started a smaller amplitude.
Yeah.
Then will you actually match these points again?
Yes, I'll show that in a second. Yeah. Exactly. Any others? Okay. So what we see is that if you normalize the velocity to the speed of sound, which is governed by the interactions, by the chemical potential, and you plot the damping versus that speed for different chemical potentials, or the chemical potential, or different, I should say, disorder strengths, or the disorder strength normalized the chemical potential, you find very much a universal-like behavior, where the damping is roughly the same. It's really difficult for us to get into the low velocities here because the speed of sound is almost a non-interacting gas. The speed of sound is extremely small, so we only have a few data points. But I think it's clear over in these others that you get this kind of universal-like curve that is holds for strong interactions, the 3D regime, or weak interactions in the 1D regime, or even close to a non-interacting gas.
How do you generate these solid curves? Is a Damm-Oxlater behavior?
So each one of these points is a different amplitude, initial amplitude in the oscillation, a different displacement of the trap. And then we fit those oscillations to a damped oscillator to extract beta.
Do these error bars allow to distinguish between three curves? Because they're rather large and close to the origin. So at least I could put the curve from the weakly interacting regime, and it would fit also to the non-interacting regime.
Well, there's no points over on the other side here, so. It's pretty difficult to draw much conclusion from this one, but it is consistent at least with the others. All right, so you can do kind of a
Can you give two transmissions back? Yeah, one more time.
Yeah.
I'm still confused. I think the same question actually.
Yeah.
So your point is that initially when you start with high velocity,
yeah.
you're right here, right on this side of the of this picture, right? So there's no superfluid. Are you saying that when it moves, because it's moving greater than lambda critical velocity, there's no superfluid? Are you saying that?
I'm saying it's damped, yeah.
No, but then how does the superfluid come back? Because if you've destroyed superfluidity by that velocity, as you slow down,
yeah.
How does the superfluidity come back again?
Yeah, so all I'm saying is there's damping here, and this is the observation.
It equilibrates. I mean, if you slow down, the energy is conserved, and then gradually go back to here. So you go back to the regime where below the critical velocity. So.
But it's never in equilibrium. On the other hand, why does it have? Why would it have time to condense? Actually, that's not really obvious.
Well, that's the same question again. I mean, it looks like it probably can all be described by Gross-Podiebski equation. Do you agree
yeah.
with that?
Yeah. I do agree with that, yeah.
Actually, to the extent that very little, this GP is by definition, there's no excitation. Everything is in condensate.
Uh-huh.
So to the extent, there are very few. I mean, if the system always protected.
If you linearize around some given solution, you will. The Gross-Podiebski knows about the
normal
load solutions. In that sense, it can know about the Landau superfluidity criterion. And I think it's not unreasonable to think that you'll see more rapid damping when the thing is moving.
I agree with you. But the question is that whether Wendy doesn't like to hear this, but whether there's substantial heating during the experiment, because then there would be some finite fraction that going into the.
It depends on what you define as heating. There's certainly excitations going on here, but that's what the dissipation is from.
Yeah, the question is that if there's a lot of excitation, whether the GP is able to handle that. If the excitation fraction is small, then I can certainly do GP as you say. But I think
it's tempted to think that this is probably true if the length scale of the disorder is large compared to the healing length, which mm-hmm. I guess it is.
Which is the case. Yeah. At least it's the case here. It's not necessarily the case in those. In the other.
It's entirely reasonable that GP would give that kind of curve.
Yeah. That's not true here. Because here the healing lengths are big compared to the disorder. Yeah.
Just a comment on the liberation time. I think since using the weak disorder limit, so the time scales for liberation is determined by temp potential. So this is still reasonably fast compared faster than the time of oscillations. I think. So I think if you reduce the velocity,
mm-hmm.
then the system would have time to get back to a good condensate. The situation would be different if you get to a high barrier height, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But which we shall see.
So all of these are very, very weak disorder, because the damping here, these are all systems which are relatively underdamped. Organizational question, am I going to stop at 10, at 11?
If you can, but you can go on a little bit longer.
Okay.
Don't worry too much about it.
Okay, well, I'm roughly halfway through.
Oh.
And I'm approximately three quarters of the way through the, let's just check and see what the...
Yeah, that's
it.
Sometimes.
Okay, I'm on slide 14 out of 27 or 28.
You're certainly far from the worst, actually.
I'm far from the worst?
Just go on,
yeah. Okay, well, that's good to know. All right, so let's move on. So you can kind of make a phase diagram where I'm plotting here the damping coefficient, which is in color. This is a contour map. For speeds normalized to the local Landau velocity versus disorder strength over here, going from all the way up to about 0.5 of the chemical potential. And what you find is that, of course, if the disorder is small, there's very little damping. As you increase the disorder, the damping grows and reaches a maximum at vehicle one, and you go to higher velocities, presumably it's more of a classical gas, and damping becomes small again. And when you go up to relatively high disorder strength, say about 0.4, the damping is very strongly peaked at vehicles one, and again is still relatively large even for small velocities. All right, so there's a superfluid down here, we know that. This is undamped up in here. I don't know what you call this regime. It's more of a, it's certainly not a, a superfluid regime, but it's more of a ideal gas or classical gas regime.
Yeah. Yes, that's because the harmonic oscillator motion is really protected by symmetry, so that's...
It is, yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Just not coupling to the... It's not uh-huh. like tracking something through the system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's very special.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a fairly complicated problem because of this disorder and the characteristic length scale and so on. What happens if you were to do the same experiment, but not with disorder, but with a single defect? And you can do the defect, which is either a dip or a barrier. And so the dip is some kind of a red detuned laser or laser sheet which intersects the center of the trap, and the barrier is a blue detuned one. And we can look at the same thing. We look at the damping dissipation of motion in this circumstance, compare it to the case of disorder. So this is when you have blue detuned, you have it's a dip which causes an enhanced density in the center, and that's a red detuned light sheet which causes a decreased exclusion of atoms from the center. All right, so the phase diagram actually for the single defect is asymmetric, depending on whether you have a barrier, which produces a dip in the middle of the density, or a dip in the potential, which produces an enhanced density. And the reason for that is that the local Landau critical velocity is less in the case of the barrier, because the density is decreased, than it is for the dip. And this was pointed out by a paper by Pavlov and Albert just last year. And I'll show a comparison with their theory in a moment, which is a Gross-Podievsky theory. And so this curve here represents just the change in the density due to this presence of this light sheet in the middle of the trap. So this looks a lot like the disorder case, but it's a lot simpler of a problem. So we can compare now with theory. This is the paper by Pavlov and Albert. And they have this dotted line, again, as a local Landau critical velocity. And they have a dissipative region on both sides for either a dip or a barrier that looks a lot like what we see when we plot on a similar scale. So if you compare that with the disorder case is pretty similar. So this is their theoretical phase diagram. We're only looking at this side of it for positive disorder strengths. And it's, far as their theory is concerned, it's completely symmetric, because then you have peaks and valleys in the disorder. You have barriers and dips, essentially, and it doesn't make any difference, whereas a single defect, it does. I should add here that the scale they have, they're plotting something called, they call a fluidity factor, which is kind of the inverse of the damping. And so maybe it's a little bit confusing to compare, but you can certainly, this big dissipative region over there corresponds to this dissipative region in our graph. Okay, so an interesting question is, what causes the dissipation? So we're seeing dissipation in the case of, that's very similar qualitatively in the case of either disorder or these single defects. These are images, time of flight images, that show the case where you have a barrier and strong interactions. The scattering length's about 200 Bohr. And what you see is that when the condensate crosses the center of the trap, the barrier eats out a big hole in the middle. There's a big exclusion from that point defect. And you also see in time of flight, you see a lot of fringes. It's maybe even more evident here, which seem to indicate that there are some excitations in the system, which is certainly the expectation. The question is what those excitations might be. The calculations of Albera et al. Indicate that these are somehow the emissions of solitons, dark solitons, which these may be. There was a paper by Peter Engels a couple of years ago in which he interpreted similar kind of observation to dark solitons or some kind of a linear phonon mode. So, in 1D, if you reduce the interactions considerably, now we're reducing the interactions by about a factor of 300, qualitatively, the condensate looks different. So this is the same, basically the same barrier that we had before. These are in situ images, meaning in the trap. You can see it, the condensate, when it goes over the barrier, it kind of bifurcates, splits into two. And as it goes through multiple times, it splits up more and more until you get a bunch of relatively long wavelength fragmentation. So this is a qualitatively different behavior in this 1D weakly interacting regime than in the strongly interacting regime, and may indicate that the excitations or the dissipation mechanism is different in this regime than in the 3D. So we've looked then a little bit further at this issue by doing time of flight images. And basically what we're trying to do is to relate the coherence properties of the condensate to the damping that's observed. And so we take this condensate in the presence of disorder and we let it go. We have the disorder is on, then we let it go in free expansion for a few milliseconds, and then take images. And over here on the right are those time of flight images, and over here on the left are what we call in situ images. So these are images of real density, and these are images of an interference pattern that you get after the condensate's allowed to free expand for some period of time. So in the case of zero disorder, then you get a relatively smooth either in situ or time of flight image. As you start cranking up the disorder strength, this is 0.3 mu, the condensate begins to develop these density modulations, and those density modulations translate into some phase modulations in the time of flight image, which give you fringes which are actually quite a bit deeper than the initial density modulation. And if you go up further, the density modulation increases, continues to grow, gets deeper. This is starting to flatten out. These modulations are almost maximum. go up even further, this is now this order of about the chemical potential, get very deep fragmentation. These are now looking like they're almost separate little condensates. And over in here, this time of flight time of flight interference pattern is starting to decrease in contrast. And so how do we interpret that? Well, over in here, remember that there was no global superfluidity for this disorder strength. We saw the damping of dipole oscillations was overdamped in that regime. But there is nonetheless still phase coherence. This is very similar to, I think, to like a granular superconductor, where you have some kind of local coherence. Now, local coherence can give rise to this kind of an interference pattern. But as you go even further in disorder strength, this condensate is beginning to fragment into smaller and smaller chunks, and those smaller and smaller chunks are then having their contrast in the time of flight is getting smaller and smaller. So these interference patterns, I should add, this is important in the interpretation, this interference pattern is completely repeatable. And the fact that it is repeatable shot to shot means that the phase fluctuations in the condensate, initial phase fluctuations, play no role. Okay, so what's going on is this density modulations are being converted into phase modulations.
But you do expect the phase fluctuation to play a role if it's in granular regime with large separation.
And that may in fact be going on down here. And so these are completely repeatable. Down in here, a lot of this structure may not be, but it's getting into the kind of the ability to resolve it.
What happened? You wait longer.
In time of flight?
Yeah.
In our case, we don't have any signal anymore if we wait longer. That's a technical problem. It would be nice to be able to wait longer because you'd be able to probe longer distance scales, probe coherence over a greater range. So this is the contrast of both the in situ images continues to grow with increasing disorder as the condensate fragments. And this is the contrast for the time of flight images. And that rises, hits a peak, and then falls for greater disorder strength. And so these in situ images are really showing that this increasing density modulation, this fragmentation of the condensate, which is getting deeper and deeper with increasing disorder, but the time of flight images show there's still coherence remaining, some local coherence, that at least, that remains to produce these reproducible time of flight interference. So the condensate's still connected. So there is still phase relationships between adjacent parts of this condensate. At really high disorder strength, the condensate time of flight contrast diminishes as the condensate fragments into multiple Bose-Einstein condensates. And so this is, I think, getting at your question, Jason. If we had longer time of flight, then you would probe larger distances. In our case, this omega z times the time of flight is small compared to one, and so really only probing, we're not, you know, overlapping this part of the cloud with this part, we're overlapping this part with this part. All right, so this is the end. What we found is that there's some kind of universal damping in this ohmic regime, which is, depends on the ratio of V over C, depends on the Landau critical velocity, and it also depends on the disorder strength normalized to the chemical potential. The single barrier is qualitatively similar to disorder in the sense that the damping that you see for the barrier is very similar to the damping that you see for the disorder. There's some quantitative differences having to do with the exact shape of these boundaries, but qualitatively they're very similar. And the dip is asymmetric relative to the barrier just because the Landau critical velocity is dependent on the local density, which is different on for the two cases. So this damping appears, of course, it has to be due to excitations, and you can see various types of excitation for strong interactions. We see these, which may be proliferation of dark solitons. It's hard to have a good experimental criterion for whether that is a dark soliton or not. But for low interactions, there's a fragmentation of the condensate into multiple pieces, and this wavelength actually gets bigger as the interaction strength gets smaller. Okay, so let me acknowledge the people. Yang Chen, who's no longer with us, he's on the faculty at Purdue, and Yang is actually the guy who got us into this work on disorder. It was his idea. And also, Scott Pollack and Dan Dries have done most of the recent work having to do with the dissipation, with both the disorder and the defect dissipation. And James built the disorder system. He got the optical system going. So that's it. Thanks.
We certainly
damped
Randy's superfluid talk a lot.
We
should still have time for
it's only
11:04. Yeah, go ahead. You were showing these experiments with a single potential barrier. Are you able to observe something like Josephson effect?
You would if you had two separate condensates that you put a barrier in between them. If you could make the barrier width small enough that you could have some tunneling, some coupling, you could in fact see Josephson coupling.
And are you able to?
We have not done that experiment. No.
But is it within the reach?
It would be difficult because the barrier, it's difficult to make the barrier small enough. And so what you end up, we looked at this in the case of fermions too. It'd be very interesting in the case of BEC-BCS crossover to see some kind of Josephson effect. But the problem is that you want the barrier width to be at least not bigger than the coherence length of a gap. And optically, it's difficult to make the barrier width to be much smaller than maybe 10 microns. It's for technical reasons. Diffraction. And so what happened is that instead of having a tunneling barrier, you have an over-the-top coupling, which is still, you can still have a Josephson effect having coupling which is not actually due to tunneling, but just some kind of a weak link be over the barrier. That's fine. But number fluctuations kill you. Mm. And so, you know, sometimes you're exponentially sensitive, and so sometimes, you know, the chemical potential is above the barrier, and sometimes it's below it. And so it doesn't work that well. People have seen a Josephson effect in both condensates, but the way they've done it is they've engineered a double well system that had a small defect in the middle, which was of order a wavelength, using basically an optical lattice. Kind of a different scheme than what we have here.
I have just a quick question to understand. Normally, hydrodynamics, when you move something with velocity close to a speed of sound or speed of light, becomes tricky. Is any like a special point in, I'm still trying to understand that you showed number of slides, but is anything specific about being close to a speed of sound locally? Do you see any, is this soliton somehow related, or it's, I mean, is a relation whether you drag it?
Well, I think the answer is yes. The dissipation is maximum at the speed of sound.
Because I was thinking, is it possible to do kind of complementary type of experiment? Imagine that you design your condensate like a cigar, and mm-hmm. then you take another atom, which like a defect, but you allow it just to fall down gravitationally. Mm-hmm. And then, for example,
A single atom,
which is not in the condensate, outside atom, which falls down gravitationally, should somehow experience this friction. And I'm sure that, for example, you can measure like time delay for flight or whatever and see what is this frictional force? Because at least for me, it's not so clear what the nature of the damping and what causes, what the mechanism for it is.
A single atom experiment like that is not really feasible. There's no way that you'd be able to see a single atom. We don't have that kind of.
But no. I mean, can you detect it, say, if something falls through the condensate and you see it afterwards coming? You, of course, do not follow it all the way through, but I'm sure that you can detect it when it goes through and comes out. I'm sure that you can see that something is coming out from the condensate.
I could tell you're a theorist. We can't detect single atoms, but I mean, maybe your idea, if you had a clump of atoms.
Yeah, see, of course. I mean, I'm not talking about this.
Something
which moves through the condensate.
Maybe a small condensate.
Say,
that's an interesting idea.
Of course I'm.
I actually don't quite know what your original motivation is in studying this system. The question whether one just wants to find out the lambda critical velocity or whether one wants to understand certain issues in these other systems, or whether one wants to look at the correlation between phase coherence and dissipation.
All of the above.
Yeah, if that were the case, then I would have thought that more, let's say, supply is put on a lattice rather than disorder system, then I at least can address a number of them more, a number of questions, but so more precisely, because those are systems, but those are settings that one can analyze it much clearly. But I think the reason, I just want to mention, I wasn't clear, I think wasn't clear enough in some of the comments before. I think that there are a lot of similarity between some of these systems and the super solid, which is now still, I think some of the problem of that we're not able to make that much progress is because there's some of the issues, are hard to settle. But for example, I think those issues I think can be settled here more easily if you have a lattice rather than a disorder. So then you drag a lattice through a regular lattice, and then one can really study and you gradually turn up the lattice height, and then you can begin to break down the superfluid. I think then one can really see at the point where the superfluid is about to break down a rather weak superfluid, and what the correlation between density of it, coherence and damping. So is it possible in the experiments to create a lattice tracking through three-dimensional system such that within the system there are still a number, there are at least two or three lattice sites in the narrow directions, and you would have many lattice sites in long directions. So if that's feasible, I think that is a very, repeating this experiment in that setting would be really helpful.
Okay, well, we should talk about that. I don't know what issues that you would like to resolve in a lattice that we can't do here, because, this system is, you can't get anything simpler than a single defect.
I was referring to some issues in helium experiments.
Okay.
There's some, for example, at the moment, the critical velocity is not understood. It's a function of velocity, and they have some very specific behavior, and the damping is also not understood, which both of you measure. So I think it would be very helpful to at least understand it thoroughly in this system. And in the lattice, that's because it seems like it's easier to analyze the problem. I can go from a GP regime to really quantum regime where the GP begin to fail, and that. But it's just easier to analyze it. I understand it is exactly the same type of measurement. That's why it's so nice that instead of doing this, you just put.
More question?
Yeah. I'm just following up on Akim's question actually. So if you do the experiment at different temperatures, right, then you could actually see how much of the friction is coming from the normal, you know, the sort of excitations out of the condensate. And you could sort of try and, you know, I don't know, I didn't quite understand the mechanism of your dissipation, but you could sort of try to separate the sort of usually understood mechanism of dissipation, which is coming from the normal piece of the fluid, and whatever else is that you are suggesting. So you could try to do it at different temperatures and see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another question. So it's very serious. Maybe the core transition, what happened?
Yeah. So I guess what I would expect is that, no, I guess I don't have a good intuition for that. That's a good idea.
Before we end for today, I need to do two things very quickly. First, I need to get a poll of how many people are around next week, which happens to be March 8th. For those who are here, raise your hand. Okay. Among you, who would be interested in giving a talk or many talks? One or the other. Nobody wants to give a talk? Okay.
No.
I mean, I'm talking about those people who are here. Okay. Okay, well, I mean, if you don't want to raise your hand, you can tell me privately, or Donna, okay?
Okay.
So then Christiane will tell us the fun part. She will tell us about the restaurant she picked for the group dinner tonight. Yeah.
Okay, so it's an Italian restaurant. It's called Cadario. They had a selection, so the population of Santa Barbara has been voting for the best restaurants in Santa Barbara. They had lots of people, and they selected the best in each kind of food. So last week we went to the best Vietnamese, and this week is the best Italian. Apparently this one was also the best of the best. So I was scared by the price, but it looks reasonable. They have antipasti from $7 to $12, pasta from $11 to $15, and meat, which is a second, from $21 to $25. So looks reasonable. It's close to State Street. It's a crossing of State Street. The address is going to be in our...
Yeah, it's on the wiki now, so you can sign up on the wiki or send us an email.
Is it good? Okay, so we have a local who confirms what the other local said.
Yeah, so as usual, the instruction and stuff will be posted on the wiki, and please sign up on the wiki, and in particular tell us. So that Christian can make the reservation with the proper number. And of course, tell us if you need a ride, and in particular, if you can provide a ride for other people.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, you should make a reservation.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. So thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Randy.
Yeah. Very good.